This is the takeaway for Monday, February 13th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. An early internal battle in the young Trump administration. Is that what we have here? On this Monday, President Trump's National Security Advisor Michael Flynn may have discussed Russian sanctions with the Russian ambassador to the United States. The things he suggested to this high-level Russian official are in direct contradiction with other White House officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, who has a very high profile in this administration so far. Flynn's conduct may be considered inappropriate and possibly illegal, but it also shows just how unclear U.S.-Russian policy is right now, at least as far as the public is concerned. On Air Force One Friday, President Trump said he would, quote, look into the allegations. And Stephen Miller, Trump's top domestic security advisor, showing an extraordinary talent for self-preservation, was mum on ABC this week.
I don't have any information, George, to change anything that has previously and already been said by the White House on this matter. General Flynn has served this country admirably and with distinction. He's a three-star general. He served in the Defense Intelligence Agency. There's no information that I have as the policy director for this White House to contribute any new information to this story this morning.
Stephen Miller, the domestic security advisor. Ryan Goodman is editor-in-chief of Justice Security, and he served as special counsel to the Department of Defense from 2015 to 2016. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
So how far out of line was the national security advisor, who's normally considered to be pretty close to the policy loop, or inside the policy loop at the very least, in the White House?
So it seems as though he might have been quite far out of line. Actually, I could even describe it as going rogue, especially since we now are led to believe that he actually lied to Vice President Pence and to the White House spokesperson, Sean Spicer, in telling them that the content of these phone calls had nothing to do with the sanctions. So that sounds as though he was operating somewhat on his own, if that's accurate.
Now, he says they had nothing to do with these sanctions. Does that mean that the White House believes that, well, he probably was talking about the sanctions?
Right. So at this point, it looks as though right before Vice President Pence went out in public on the Sunday shows and right before Sean Spicer went out for his first press briefing after the inauguration weekend, they both said that they had relied on Flynn's statements to them that nothing in the phone calls dealt with the sanctions. All of that's now being reversed.
And that comes from the Russian ambassador? That comes from sources close to the Russian ambassador? Where does that come from?
So it comes from nine former and current intelligence officials, U.S. officials, that the Washington Post picked up on Thursday night in a major blockbuster kind of article. And then the New York Times that next morning, Friday morning, also came out with their report as well, that these officials say that the content of these phone calls most certainly dealt with the Russian sanctions. They actually have a transcript of it. And then as of last night, the Wall Street Journal has an article which says that Flynn has now kind of come clean with his White House colleagues, in which he has no choice but to do so because now he's faced with the transcripts themselves.
Flynn, how long ago was he a general, or is he a general now?
Well, he stepped down. He's a retired general,
right.
And he stepped down in 2014.
So on the one hand, this could be an argument for why we have civilians controlling national security policy. Would you say that's a plausible conclusion to draw here as a layperson?
Absolutely. I think that in this particular role, having only the experience of the military, one doesn't get to see other dimensions that a State Department person would have or kind of a policy person from other forms of professional experience in the government. And that's possibly what's partly lacking here.
All right. So let's take the other side then. Let's take the most possibly sympathetic view of General Flynn and say, if I was Flynn and was looking at the headlines and going to the meetings and looking at the tweets of President Trump and maybe taking a look at the campaign rhetoric, I would have no idea what to talk to the Russian ambassador about. Maybe he was just, kind of going over stuff that in the chaotic early days of the Trump administration seemed plausible to him.
Right. So I think that might be the most charitable reading of it, that in fact, if anything, he's reading from the president's statements that there will be a new overture towards the Russians. And that's all he's really communicating to them is that after January 20th, there'll be a kind of a new opening, a new relationship. What's highly suspicious, though, of course, is that this conversation is taking place on the day that the United States government under the Obama administration announces its sanctions for the Russian hacking of the election, and that they did not clear the conversation with the White House beforehand. The White House was actually pretty specific about coming out and saying this wasn't cleared with us.
So that's the rogue. Going rogue.
That sounds like it's going rogue.
Is that illegal?
So it's debatable as to whether or not it's illegal. It certainly seems to be undermining the policy of the U.S. government. The one part of the U.S. federal law that people turn to is this provision called the Logan Act, which does in fact prohibit citizens from engaging in public diplomacy with foreign governments in order to try to defeat the measures of the U.S. government. That would seem to apply here, but that's a 1799 statute. It has never been enforced for over 200 years. The idea that this would actually be something criminally prosecuted is difficult to believe.
Well, and then we've got Trump's style in just a few seconds here. I mean, the commander in Afghanistan talked kind of loose to the Rolling Stone magazine and was out in a matter of 20 seconds. This guy's dead meat here, right?
Well, I think Trump is so worried about looking as though the White House is in chaos. It would look as though things are really running amok. So I think that's one public perception that he's trying to avoid in these early days. But he should maybe realize that actually in trying to get your ship straight, you might just feel as though certain people just don't fit with your administration, and you learn that pretty quickly.
Ryan Goodman is editor-in-chief of Just Security and served as special counsel to the Department of Defense from 2015 to 2016. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So who will go down in contemporary history as the deporter-in-chief? Latino lawmakers and activists in the U.S. used that derogatory term to describe President Obama in the midst of that Democratic president's efforts to try to implement some kind of immigration policy when the Congress would do nothing. Now President Donald Trump may be competing for the same title, but he has a long way to go to reach the well over 2.5 million Obama deportees. In at least a half dozen states, though, hundreds of undocumented immigrants were arrested over the past few days by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE. Gang members, drug dealers, and others are being removed, quote, said Trump on Twitter. But as was the case of Obama, who tried to exclude only criminals in his huge dragnet, non-criminals were caught as well. And according to officials, the Trump deportations includes immigrants without a criminal record as well. Camille Mackler is director of legal initiatives for the New York Immigration Coalition. She joins me now. How do you see this?
This is hugely problematic and hugely concerning. I can't underscore how terrified and panicked our immigrant communities have been since last week. And we're just working really hard to try to counter that, but it's devastating.
So the sort of the chaos that was associated with the Obama era is probably not that much different from the Trump era. But in this particular case, you've got last week's real drama added to this week's. Now we're going after people who aren't from the seven countries. And so it's an additional kind of Trump particular chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I think under the previous administration, we had some pretty firm guidelines of who they were going to go after. And by and large, they adhered to them. They were definitely large in numbers. But we had a better sense of what to expect in many ways. And I think it sort of seems – it feels like a free-for-all right now with this administration. And I think combining it with the very inflammatory rhetoric of the campaign and of the first few months of the administration, the executive orders, everything that happened with the travel ban and now this, it's chaos and it's complete fear. And right now it just feels like an all-out war on immigrants. And we are the ones who are going to lose at the end of the day if this continues.
So when talk radio says it's just like Obama, it's just like it was before, blah, 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 that's absolutely not the case from your perspective.
No, I think just in this past week alone, just in this last round of quote-unquote raids, two things really struck me as being different. The first one is the amount of collateral arrests, right? They were going in, they were supposedly seeking specific individuals, but it looks like they caught and arrested a lot more people who under Obama may not have been taken in at the same time.
So the collateral arrests would be, we're looking for person A, we go to address B. We don't know if person A is there, but there are 30 people there. We take them all in.
Exactly.
Really?
Exactly. And we didn't see that as much. We saw that under the Bush administration, the last 8 years that had sort of reduced. And it seems we didn't see it so much in New York, but in California and Atlanta and the Carolinas, that definitely seems to have been the case from what we're starting to piece together now. The other part of it is sort of this more public attack on immigrants, right? They're putting out press releases. They say they're going to be putting out more information and photos today. The executive orders call for weekly lists of immigrants. I mean, the demonization of immigrants is incredible to see, incredible to witness, and really not just demoralizing but harmful to the immigrants but to their families.
If these folks get taken and don't manage to see a lawyer by the time they're actually put in detention, where do they end up and how long does it take them to get out if they associate themselves with an organization like yours?
So that really varies on, first of all, on the state.
State to state, sure.
Yeah, but also what part of the proceedings the immigrants, the individuals are in. If they already have a deportation order, they could be gone within days.
So they're out of here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw that in Arizona over the weekend, when this woman just sort of within 24 hours was back in Mexico. If they don't have a previous deportation order or they assert a fear of returning home, then they may be here for weeks, months, and then depending on how long.
But in a detention center,
in
right?
In a detention
center, they're not in like the Motel 6.
No, absolutely. Right now many of them are in county jails in New Jersey, of those who were caught in New York.
Right.
And in New York we have this sort of public defender system for immigrants that's been funded by the city, which is very lucky because it means that they'll connect to a lawyer. But traditionally, very few immigrants who are detained manage to obtain representation, and so they end up losing their cases and being ordered deported.
Where do you think this is headed? Is this likely to be challenged in the same way that some of the other immigration orders of the president have already been challenged successfully?
I hope so. I mean, when we saw this happen, you know, under the Bush administration, there were a lot of Fourth Amendment challenges to unreasonable search and seizure during these kinds of arrests. And I think we are all as a legal community gearing up and looking into that. I think anything that can be challenged will be challenged in immigration courts, in other, you know, federal courts. But we're not going down without a fight, that's for sure.
When you hear on talk radio and elsewhere that, hey, look, you went to law school and now you're going to claim that people who aren't even Americans have 14th Amendment and due process rights when they're not even citizens?
Yeah, absolutely. This is – if you're in the United States, you get constitutional rights. Immigrants in many areas have less constitutional rights. For example, they're entitled to a lawyer but not a lawyer paid for by the government. But they are entitled to constitutional protections. That's what makes America different from any other place in the world, is that we have a rule of law and it applies to everyone.
Camille Mackler is Director of Legal Initiatives for the New York Immigration Coalition. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's nothing like the voice of singer Al Jarreau. High, low, soft, belted out, as light as a feather, and as precise as a saxophone riff. He's gone at age 76, and we heard from many of you with memories to share.
Hi, this is Michelle. I'm calling from Arlington. Elvis for Lovers is one of my favorite Al Jarreau albums. It reminds me of my early 20s. I can still remember probably dancing through my apartment listening to this album.
Give us your recollections. 8778 My Take. Sing it out. The drama of an armed standoff goes into court today in Nevada, pitting cattle rancher Cliven Bundy and federal agents into a battle that could easily become an armed standoff again if reported tensions in the West over federal land policy are any indication of the potential for ranchers to take matters into their own hands all over the West, including Nevada, where this case is taking place. The dramatic face-off involved a 20-year dispute with the Bureau of Land Management over illegal grazing on public land. This is the second in a series of two separate trials involving public land and people associated with the Bundy family. The first trial in Oregon acquitted the Bundy's sons and other leaders in the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Jenny Wilson is federal courts reporter for the Las Vegas Review and has been covering the latest trial. Jenny, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
So the TikTok here is, once upon a time, the Bundys started grazing their land without a permit on federal land, right?
Yes, well, this starts back decades ago. Clive and Bundy had been letting his cattle roam freely over hundreds of thousands of acres of federal land. He owns a plot of about 160 acres near that federal land and was just letting his cattle roam freely.
The feds figured out that they needed to get a permit and said, hey, Clive and Bundy, you need to get your permit. And he either ignored it or refused.
Correct. The feds wanted, you know, they were trying to obtain grazing fees. Eventually, what he owed the federal government was $1 million in grazing fees. And they went and obtained a court order that authorized the Bureau of Land Management to impound the cattle.
And that happened in 2014. And the feds moved in and described the circumstances that then will become really the evidence that's presented in this case.
Correct. So when the feds started the cattle roundup, when they obtained the contract cowboys, started rounding up the cattle to impound them, that was when the Bundys responded with protests.
And protests eventually became what I just described as an armed standoff. That just means people were holding guns. Nobody actually got shot, right?
Correct. And the Bundys actually dispute the term armed standoff. The federal government calls it an armed standoff. The Bundys say that they were peacefully protesting. That's really the core of the dispute that will play out in this first trial.
Is this a jury trial or a judge trial?
It's a jury trial. And I want to make it clear that the Bundys are actually not on trial yet. They're set to be tried later this year.
So this is 17 members of the group who were a part of this standoff.
17 people are facing trial. The first six of them are up right now. And these are the people that the government describes as the least culpable.
From your perspective as a reporter, are the Bundys heroes or crackpots when you encounter people and ask people about them?
I think it very much depends on who you speak to. That was clear from hearing some of the jury questionnaires that were returned to the court. There are some people that are very, very sympathetic with the Bundys, some people who stand with the Bundys against the federal government. There were others. I mean, one prospective juror wrote on his questionnaire that Bundy was a terrorist. So you have seen a very wide spectrum in this jury pool, which is why it's going to be interesting. You know, you 12 one way or 12 the other way. One off and the jury's hung.
And in the case of the Oregon trial, the Bundy sons were acquitted. Did the lawyer say that has any bearing here, that that's hanging over the head of the people trying to prosecute this case?
I think it's certainly hanging over the head of people trying to prosecute the case. I don't think that it necessarily has changed their strategy or the way they've approached it. But to say that they hadn't noticed that acquittal up in Oregon would be silly. It was after that acquittal that prosecutors requested to try these 17 defendants in three different groups. So how it affected their trial strategy, that's something we'll see in the coming weeks.
What are the very specific charges here, just for a second?
Threats, assault, conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, extortion. There's a whole list of, I think it's roughly a dozen charges that they're facing.
And the extortion relates to the non-payment of fees, right?
The extortion relates to trying to extort federal agents into leaving the cattle and ceasing the impoundment operations.
So that's their most menacing way of characterizing the non-payment of bills, right?
Not necessarily the non-payment of bills, but their refusal to let the federal government carry out the court order authorizing the impoundment.
Now, I mean, the reason I ask that as precisely as that, because what is the chance here that a jury would say the Bundys or this group or, you know, these least culpable six don't have to pay any bills? I'm sorry. This is America. The federal government's overreached. We don't care what the rules say. They don't have to pay. Can a judge overrule that? I mean, does that have any standing at all? Or is it just 12 people angry at the feds?
Well, it's not up for the jury to decide whether or not Clive and Bundy needs to pay his bills. That is not the issue that's on trial. What the jury will be deciding is whether or not a crime was committed when these protests resulted on April 12th in an armed confrontation between the BLM agents and the protesters, who had driven down and joined the protests for a wide variety of reasons. A lot of the people that this case roped in were people who started reading about it online and came down to protest what they viewed as a menacing federal government. For example, the six gunmen standing trial right now, they didn't really have any interest in the core cattle grazing fee dispute. And they've actually tried to distance themselves from that in opening statements to the jury.
Jenny Wilson, federal courts reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thank you very much.
So how do other ranchers see these Nevada cases? Keith Nance has been grazing cattle in Maupin, Oregon for a decade at Dillon Land and Cattle Company, a ranch known for its high-end grass-fed products. But he takes an old view of the frustrated farmers and federal regulators. Nance says he's a far cry from the Bundys and the way his men protested, but he clearly understands the sentiment.
I think it's been a long time coming. I think that there's a lot of regulation that continues to come down from the federal government. And I don't think most people out here in the West are not going to take it to the extreme that the Bundys have. With that said, there's lots and lots of frustration on a constant basis with the federal government and the regulations that we have to deal with on a daily basis just to survive in a dwindling economy in rural West.
So would you say the Bundys have brought this on themselves, or are they fighting the good fight for all of you?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that they probably brought some of it on themselves. Like, again, that's kind of a Pandora's box question, and there's lots of variables inside of that conversation. Some of that the Bundys are probably brought on, and I think there's also standing up for a lot of other folks that are out here in the West that are very frustrated.
Now, I'm looking at that Pandora's box metaphor you just used. What's come out of the box here?
I think that what's coming out of the box is all the frustrations that have built up over time, whether that be environmental regulation, whether that be grazing regulations, whether that be restrictions on our business from taxes, all these different things that have been built up over time, gets very, 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 very frustrating. In my last article at the Washington Post, I also stated that we don't necessarily agree with the tactics of the Bundys and how they've gone about this process. We want to have our voices heard, but not in an overly aggressive way.
Would you help someone who is a fugitive from the federal government, not the Bundys, if they got in some of the similar kind of trouble, given the fact that there's a lot of frustration, a lot of tension out there?
I think there's lots of variables inside that question. It's a pretty dangerous question to answer.
Yeah, I don't want to get you in trouble. It's a total hypothetical, and I'm going to say that up front, but would you think about it?
I would think about it, absolutely. I'm not just going to turn them away. I would think about it. I would ask some questions and see what the variables are surrounding that situation.
Are we headed towards a nasty, argument between the regulators and the farmers in the West, or more like a land war?
You know, I think there's just more conversations that need to be had. I don't know if there necessarily needs to be any kind of a major land war. We have been pushed to almost to an extreme in the West on how we are able to use our lands. I'm a firm believer in balance and coming to the table and having conversation with regulators and with our public land agencies. But most of the time that doesn't get heard. There's a top-down driven agenda most of the time from our standpoint. And we don't have that autonomy to make those correct decisions or have the autonomy to sit down and have open conversation about what we need to continue to survive in this landscape.
Obama was not on your side, and Trump is on your side. Is that your conclusion at this point?
I could easily make that conclusion. I think that Obama was very, very far removed from what we do and how we do it. He's several thousand miles away and handing down regulations to us without a true understanding of how it affects us. As far as Trump goes, I think there's still a lot yet to be seen. At this point, it seems to be probably going to be more favorable than Obama.
He does live in a gold tower, though, Keith.
That is very true, but I think you can also look at some of the people that he's appointing into his administration, Ryan Zenke, and then Sonny Perdue, some of those individuals that have a better understanding of ranching and farming in the West and are going to be more favorable to us as we move forward. But those are to be seen.
Keith Nance, I really appreciate your candor here.
You bet.
Keith Nance is a ranch manager at Dillon Land and Cattle in Maupin, Oregon. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, John.
When it comes to sports dynasties, the University of Connecticut women's basketball team is unparalleled.
78-0. Connecticut has won the national championship again.
Connecticut to inbound, and UConn has one up UCLA. 89 consecutive wins, more than anyone in college basketball Division I history.
It's been building an undefeated streak since it lost to Stanford back in the fall of 2014.
So there's an old saying, You can't win all the time, except this team seems to consistently want to bust that cliche. Ladies and gentlemen, for the fourth year in a row, give it up for the NCAA champion, UConn Huskies.
This UConn team that has won 99 in a row.
Now, with a victory over 6th-ranked South Carolina, tonight the Huskies will win 100 games in a row. This feat by head coach Gino Auriemma strings together 2 undefeated seasons and 4 straight NCAA tournament championships. Do the team's stars, Gabby Williams, Katie Lou Samuelson, and Nafisa Collier, have what it takes to push this legendary team into triple digits? Michelle Vopel is an ESPN.com columnist.
It's an amazingly consistent dynasty, and I think the consistency is the part that impresses so many people. 11 national championships. They've had 6 undefeated seasons and then 4 other seasons where they had just 1 loss. So that is pretty staggering right there. And, you know, they've had the same head coach, Gino Auriemma, and his associate head coach, Chris Daly, since 1985. So the consistency there, I think, is a big part of what's made them so successful, that consistency of message and method.
And is it something like the way people have been describing the Patriots, that everybody understands you do your job, there's nobody special, everybody is just like, coached, and that's the way it goes?
Absolutely. And I think that's, they're able to recruit that way. They're looking for recruits who aren't just really, really talented, obviously, to play there, but understand that you do have a role to play, even if you're a superstar player. And that's something they're able to turn away certain players who they don't feel fit the mentality, even if they're very talented players. So they've been able to get that type of player over a long period of time.
Which is why their bench is just as scary as their starters.
And you look at this current season, they lost the first 3 picks to the WNBA draft in Breanna Stewart, Mariah Jefferson, and Morgan Tuck. And so you would think, okay, any team that loses, you know, 3 players or the top 3 players to go to the professional league, they're going to struggle. And they haven't, because the players that didn't play as much last year were ready to step into bigger roles this season and have done that.
Wow. What does this say, if anything, about the level of talent and or interest in the Division I women's game, because one team is just so unbelievably dominant?
I think the interesting thing about it is we have a bit of a monarchy in women's basketball, whereas if you look at Division I men's basketball, you know, I'd say it's more of a lot of different teams that are up at the top. But that list of men's teams, though, stays pretty much the same consistently. The interesting thing about women's basketball right now is if you took UConn out of the mix, you'd have no idea who was going to win the national championship. So people say, oh, there's no parity. And I said, there's a lot of parity. It's just UConn is above the parity. In all seriousness, they're more like a semi-professional team than they are a college team right now. And I say that just because of the way they play, the style of play, the mentality. They look different than other teams. So I think there is a lot of competitiveness we see in all these other conferences and at all the rest of the top 10. It's just UConn separated itself from everybody.
So is this unstoppable momentum here?
It seems like it is. This is an all reality. If Connecticut beats South Carolina, it's hard to see. They haven't lost a game in the American Athletic Conference, which was formed in 2013-14. They haven't lost to a single one of those opponents. So if they don't lose to South Carolina, they're going to go into the NCAA tournament. They're going to play their first 2 games at home. Then they're going to be in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So it's hard to see them losing before the Final Four in Dallas. A possibility they could lose in Dallas. Baylor is a team that if they make it could give them some problems. But right now, I would not be surprised to see another perfect season.
Michelle Vopel is an ESPN.com columnist. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Among the major issues in the federal trials in Nevada against gunmen protesters who allegedly turned sympathetic toward ranchers fed up with the federal regulators is the federal seizing of citizen property, an awesome power not to be taken lightly, and they're certainly not taking it lightly out in Nevada, as President Trump seems to take federal power over civilians pretty lightly right here in this meeting with sheriffs at the White House last week.
We've got a state senator in Texas, it was talking about introducing legislation to require conviction before we could receive that forfeiture money.
Can you believe that?
And I told him that the cartel would build a monument to him in Mexico if he could get that legislation.
Who's the state senator? Do you want to give his name? We'll destroy his career.
Destroying a Texas state senator's career over his efforts to curtail the ability of law enforcement to seize money, cars, and property suspected of being used in crimes? Asset forfeiture is a critical tool in law enforcement's fight against drug dealers. While lawmakers with more libertarian leanings argue that allowing police to seize suspects' property before they've been convicted of a crime has led to widespread property rights violations nationwide. Maurice Chamat is a reporter at the Marshall Project.
It's yet another of these sort of criminal justice issues that scramble sort of what we thought we knew about the divide between left and right and even divide sort of within the right. So within this big picture, it's one of these tools that law enforcement use that for decades, you know, since the Reagan administration was just kind of a thing police did. No one talked much about it. Even the term asset forfeiture sounds kind of bureaucratic and boring.
They were for it, though, as I recall.
They were.
The Reagan administration was really proud of all the asset forfeiture.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, you can imagine that image of the police proudly standing with the drug dealer's mansion and his car and his jewelry, his boats. These were all – there was sort of a reasonable kind of narrative you could put behind this and say this is a way that we help fight bad guys. But over time –
it was deterrence. Part of it was punishment, but it was also deterrence. Don't mess with this because this really sort of got them where they hurt.
Absolutely. The idea is not only will you go to prison, but all of the things that you kind of worked hard to build, the things your family enjoys, et cetera, could be taken by law enforcement. And, of course, it was beneficial to law enforcement because that money often went back into their budgets and kind of helped out even as they faced, you know, budget crises and that sort of thing.
But libertarians aren't crazy to say that the government, you know, has no right to come in and take my house if I haven't been convicted of a crime, right?
Right. And a lot of the debate often centers around, you know, sort of what happens in that initial moment when they stop you on the street or they knock on your door and what they can take then and then how long it sort of takes you to prove that it's really yours and that it wasn't being used for drug dealing and to kind of get it back.
And stop and frisk, for instance, has an asset forfeiture element to it, and that got in trouble with the courts.
Right, exactly. So there's been just a series of incidents where, you know, judges have come in and said, well, wait a minute, you know, this it's not even that the person has to be dealing drugs. It just has to be their property was used. So there was a famous example of a man whose hotel was being used for drug dealing by some of the guests, and the police tried to take the hotel from him.
Now, when Trump, though, says, who is the state senator? Do you want to give his name? We'll destroy his career. He's not talking about a drug dealer or anyone who's been convicted of anything. He's talking about a civilian lawmaker who suggests a policy that's opposed to this idea. I mean, that goes way beyond anything we've been talking about here.
Absolutely. It's a very and it's such a sort of small, strange issue for this to come up over, right? I mean, it's this kind of particular criminal justice area. And you can just sort of see that Trump in this moment kind of reacted. He heard this story. It sounded really terrible to him that, you know, police officers would no longer be able to take drug dealers' cars and houses. And he suddenly said, well, that must mean this state senator is doing something awful, so I'm going to sort of hit right back at him.
And let's just give a generous view of Trump. He's, you know, mouthing off.
Or he's kidding.
Making a joke.
Everyone
laughed in the room. But on the other hand, this is the kind of thing King George said.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it made a lot of people nervous. It made a lot of – and I think it's an area where you can see that – even libertarians, people – sort of conservatives who are distrustful of big government, now that the man that they often supported is the government, you're going to start to see a little, I think, more cracks and wrinkles in the sort of political picture.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Sure.
You may not be prepared to even answer this. Has any property been seized of Trump's?
I've never
heard
of an example.
Over the course of his career?
I've never heard of an example. You know, when I was reporting this, one – an advocate who wanted to reform the asset forfeiture situation said, well, you know, if someone was dealing drugs out of Mar-a-Lago, the police could try to take it. And obviously that's never happened, and there's no evidence that anything like that has ever happened to Trump. But it's that kind of example. And you could imagine that he knows people, you know, that he knows people who have, if not lost their property, at least had a tough fight with prosecutors and law enforcement over their property. And so I'm really curious to see kind of going forward when Trump starts to kind of hear that narrative and that set of facts, how it sort of impacts his rhetoric and how he views the issue. I think that it's still an open book. You know, his first inclination was to kind of dive right towards the law enforcement perspective, but then he's going to see
destroying the senator's
career
perspective.
It's very dramatic,
right? It's beyond the law enforcement perspective.
Absolutely, and we can't sort of normalize that sort of rhetoric.
No. But, okay, so have the courts ruled on asset forfeiture? Has the Supreme Court set something down? Because he's talking about legislation here. It sounds like this is an unresolved matter.
It's unresolved. I mean, various courts have made sort of small chipping away at the ability of police to do this. But there's kind of a big broad range of laws across the country. A big part of it, though, is that the DOJ under Jeff Sessions has a lot of power in terms of kind of setting policy from the top on this program because a lot of local jurisdictions sort of work with the DOJ on asset forfeiture. So there is a big area where the federal government could kind of set course one way.
And who would file a lawsuit? El Chapo, right?
Right, exactly.
And he's not going to do it. So,
well, I mean, the ACLU and a lot of sort of property, you know, groups that care about property rights, even sort of libertarian groups, have been sort of out front on this issue. So, I would see them getting involved.
Maurice Shema is a reporter at the Marshall Project. For decades, there have been dystopian novels, movies, comic books, songs. For years, governments have been stymied by corruption, military stalemates, gridlock. In 2008, the entire global economy took a giant nosedive. One can realistically ask, after the dysfunctional 8 years of Obama and congressional gridlock, the bizarre paper money printing policies of the Federal Reserve, what's holding all this together? Doesn't feel like democracy is, or brotherhood, or national unity. What is it? Well, 3 weeks before the 2016 election, British filmmaker Adam Curtis released his new documentary, Hypernormalization. Striding along past Brexit, the rise of Donald Trump, the horrible war in Syria, terrorism, the star of this film is the state of intense anxiety and the feeling of helplessness this has all caused. Fortunately, Curtis argues that in the face of an increasingly complicated and complex world, the West has turned to politicians and economists who have a simplistic view of how things are and how they will go. Essentially, he says, we're living in a fantasy world that is all but doomed to one day catch up with reality.
Up to this point, we've had this idea that somehow we can see the world as a system, whether it's what they used to call globalization, or whether it's the economic financial system that promised stability through all those technical systems, or through intelligence agencies like the National Security Agency, who promised that they can listen in on calls and spot all terrorists. Well, none of them have actually managed to achieve any of that. They didn't see the Soviet Union collapsing. They didn't see the coming financial crisis. And even the head of the National Security Agency has admitted on a number of occasions that despite all those terrible surveillance things that they're doing to us, they've never found a terrorist as a result of it. So what I'm really saying is that we've lived through this age of these experts that seem to offer simplistic answers that enable politicians to avoid complicated and difficult questions of power. And the problem that the politicians are now facing is that they gave power away to a dream of technocratic stability with no picture of the future, none. Even Donald Trump doesn't really have a picture of the future. It's all about how can we keep this thing stable? And no one's got an answer for what people really want, which is a sense that actually this thing that you call stable is actually rather scary and we don't like it. Give us something else.
One of the things that I find really fascinating about your work is the way you view artists, particularly critical artists who fancy themselves as, you know, guardians of this impending destruction. Patti Smith, for instance, appears in Hypernormalization.
Yeah.
But you seem to have a certain contempt for these artists who don't really want to change anything. They're kind of celebrating everything going down. What do you mean by that?
I mean, you have to examine really what are the great myths of our time, the things that we all believe in. And I think one of the things that we all believe in the West is that being yourself and expressing yourself is the central thing. We all believe that. At the point that people like Patti Smith rose up in the early 70s in New York, what you were seeing was the collapse of an old idea of how you change the world. The old idea of how you change the world is you come together collectively and collectively you have power. If you are an artist expressing your disaffection with the world, you're not that powerful. I mean, you might get a lot of sort of mentions in Dazed and Confused magazine, but you won't change the world. And I mustn't blame Patti Smith alone. What I'm really saying is the shift away from collective action to self-expression has weakened the idea of changing the world. I am dubious about radical art, however beautiful and however clever it is, ever being able to really change the world. But when I say that, the artists get very upset.
What about satirists? Are they feeding the same sort of thing?
As I was coming here, I was looking at a recent copy of Rolling Stone magazine online, and it had a headline which said, "Welcome to the ignorant world of Donald Trump." And I thought, that's an interesting view of the liberals. If you really want to connect with those people who voted for Donald Trump and you want to try and change their mind, it's a bit rude. You remember all those shows? We have them here and you have them with people like Jon Stewart. Over the last 10 years, they laughed at the ignorant people, didn't they? They thought they were really stupid for supporting the Iraq War or supporting George Bush. They laughed at them and they laughed at them and they laughed at them. But that laughter, satire, is supposed to change things for the better, isn't it? That's the underlying idea, isn't it? It must be. Otherwise, why are you doing it? But it didn't. That laughter really changed the world in another way. It pissed a lot of people off. And at the moment, what you've got in America is the left might be walking into a terrible, terrible trap with Donald Trump. I mean, they're quite right to protest against his banning of Muslim people. But look at what he's doing. He is vaulting over the heads of, he's appealing over the heads of the Republicans in Congress, over the established political structure. And he's appealing to people out there in the middle of America and saying, look, see what these people I told you are doing. I want to make America safe. Look, they're laughing at you. They're laughing at you. So what the left are finding themselves doing is in a terrible trap. The more they protest, the more they're falling into the vaudeville that Donald Trump is creating, where he's saying, look at these people. Look at these people. They're laughing at you. They're being nasty to you. They don't want you to be safe. And the problem for the left, and this goes back to the idea of self-expression, is self-expression is not enough. What you have to have is an alternative vision of the future, which you can also leap over the established political structure and give it to those people out there. You don't say they're ignorant. You say, look, this is a world that we could create together that actually is better than what Donald Trump wants.
All right, finally, then, before we go, I'm willing to bet that you are either just another one of these very clever, artful, kind of grabbing corporate symbols and saying, oh, the corporations are a conspiracy, this is a conspiracy, and putting together these very clever films that just sort of take everything that we see in marketing and popular culture in the world and just setting it up as this kind of frightening, oh my God, they've got our minds. But in fact, everything will just kind of go on. It really isn't going to change that much. You're right, but we're not on the edge of collapse. Or we are, and what's next is the Visigoths. Any clue on who's the Visigoths that are going to come and take over?
No, I don't. I mean, I think what I try and do is what the BBC sets out to do, which is to try and make you look again at what's happening and try and provoke you. The function of journalism is to imaginatively pull back and show to people the dimensions of the world as it is today. And I would argue that there are two things sitting in the back of people's minds today. One is an anxiety about the future. They have no picture of the future and they feel anxious and uncertain. And secondly, a feeling that there are a lot of these things around them are not just slightly odd, they're fake. Now, I don't think that can last. And I'm not saying you're going to go down in some terrible apocalypse. All I'm saying is you've got to recapture politics and a vision of the future. And until the liberals and the left do that, you're going to get pantomime figures like Donald Trump holding them in his grasp. And that's not a great future. And people want change. They just do. You can feel it.
Adam Curtis, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Adam Curtis is a journalist and filmmaker for the BBC. His latest film is called Hyper-Normalization. You can name that in two notes, I bet. We're remembering Al Jarreau, who died yesterday at the age of 76.
This is Stephanie from Jersey. My favorite is Morning. In my mind. It is one of my top five favorite songs. I love the way my heart is happy, especially when he sings about touching the face of God. It gets me every time.
My baby says she loves me, and need I tell you that everything here is just fine.
Oh, I don't even want to talk. Let us know your favorite Al Jarreau song. Is there a special memory connected with it? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to the Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm just going to think about Al Jarreau's smile all day long. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, helping Americans with legal needs for over 15 years, including business formation and estate plans through a network of independent attorneys licensed in 48 states. More information at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.